Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to Pixels, a show where we cover the news from the video games industry. We talk about games on PCs, on consoles, on everything. I'm not saying mobile anymore, I've kind of given up on games on mobile. We'll see if some savior comes and saves us, the traditional gamers, at some point. But today we have a lot of things to talk about. Well, maybe not a lot, but specifically one interesting topic. And that is the price of games, because if we're worried that games are too expensive, then they're going to become more expensive. That doesn't make sense. So before I dive into this, we're also going to be talking about some news from Microsoft, a bunch of gaming news, the new Battle Royale game from Ubisoft, which is pretty cool. I've given it a try, and some other news. I'm Patrick Beja. Very glad to be welcoming you to Pixels. And I'm going to start, as I said, with this rumor, extrapolation, suggestion, reasoning that games might be more expensive for the next generation. That comes from one game being priced at $70 instead of $60 in the US. And the price varies depending on the region you're from. Here in Europe, they were about €70 already. They had been since the last increase that happened at the same time for everyone. That was for the PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360 generation back in 2006, I believe. And so the games cost €70 here and $60 in the US. The price isn't as different as you might think, because in the US, that price is before tax, and in the EU, that price includes tax. So it is relatively close depending on how the exchange rate goes between dollars and euros. So more or less, depending on the year, it will be, when you include the tax, roughly equivalent. The number is still a little bit higher in Europe. And what we're seeing is that that price is rising to €75 in Europe, so by €5, where it's rising to $70 in the US, so rising by $10. And to be clear, this is the price of NBA 2K on the next generation consoles, when it's at the traditional price on the current generation consoles. And that is not the price that is being applied to every game, as far as we know. Actually, I'm saying that we're starting to suspect that it might be the price that is going to be applied to every game. So that's the recommended price, the retail price that you will see, the full ticket, the full sticker price, right? And there are a number of things to say about this, because, of course, a lot of people are unhappy. People on the internet are unhappy, imagine that, and have a hard time understanding how you could justify the increase of a price that is already nominally fairly high. And I think it's worth diving into. And there are a lot of things to take into account. And I'm not going to come down on either side of, well, actually, I am going to come down on one side of the issue. I think at some point, it is understandable that game prices are going to increase. And hopefully, if you agree now, well, you already agree, so thank you. If you disagree, I would like to present to you a few elements that will hopefully make you consider things in a different way, not necessarily, you know, definitely fall on the side of, yes, they should increase, but maybe look at this in a different way at the end of the that section. The first one is, of course, inflation. And prices have not risen in almost 15 years. The price was set to $60. I'm going to use the American numbers here just for ease of use. But $60 two generations ago, so that was in 2006. And since then, the costs have increased. The inflation means that prices have increased significantly. And of course, $60 back then represented a lot more money than $60 today. Even if you get to $70 now, inflation calculator. I'm going to speak of actual terms. Let's go to an inflation calculator. I'm going to look at 2006 and do $60 and 2020 calculate. So $60 in 2006 is equivalent to $76 in 2020. So even by getting the price, by increasing the price to $70, they are not matching the actual value that they were getting in 2006 for that amount. And of course, inflation being what it is, it means that in that time, your purchasing power, on average, if you're in a bad situation, I'm sorry, but on average, your purchasing power increased more than the price of the game, even with the added $10. So relative to 2006, a game that costs $70 today is still cheaper compared to the average purchasing power than it was in 2006. So that is one thing that is important to note. The other thing that is important to note is games are a whole lot more expensive to create and to produce. And I'm not, you know, on that one, I don't have specific numbers, but I can guarantee you that most games, we're talking about AAA titles, and I'll get back to the different types of prices that exist today and that didn't exist back then. But games are a lot more expensive to produce today. You have teams of hundreds and hundreds of people, sometimes thousands of people that are needed to create all the assets and all of the art and all of the QA and all of the, even when you don't include marketing, which is also a cost to take into account, which has exploded, even for the pure coding and designing of the game itself, the cost, the budget for a game that is produced today is obviously a lot higher than it was before, because in 2006, you would create a game with a smaller team, and the game was more simple. You didn't have to be as precise in the environment you would design. The geometry of the models wasn't as complex. You didn't need to paint textures that were as complicated. And, you know, in 2006 still, I'm not going to talk about the game design itself, but suffice it to say, games were simpler to make. So that is also something to take into account. Of course, when you say that, I can hear you say already, yelling at your phone, but Patrick, you have so many more people buying the games that it averages out. Maybe it does, but I am fairly certain that the increase in budget needed for AAA titles has increased more than the potential audience for those titles. And to be completely honest, that is why we have microtransactions that have exploded as well. Now, of course, the actual main reason why we have microtransactions is that developers, like every other person on the planet or company, loves money, and they see it as a way to make more money. But it's not false to say that budgets have also exploded, and that one of the reasons why we have those additional monetization schemes is that you need to compensate for a cost that hasn't increased. And that isn't to say that with the increase of the cost, you will get that averaging out. Like, you don't need microtransactions anymore because the cost had increased. First of all, because as I mentioned, the increase of due to inflation means that even with the 10 extra bucks, you don't get as much value out of that price as you did back in 2006. And the budget having exploded for the production of the games means that you still need to bring in more money than the price that people pay on the box to make it work. There are a number of other things to take into account. Games aren't as uniformly priced as they were. You have, of course, the digital nature of purchasing means that you have less, it's less easy to get games secondhand and to pay them less. But we also, and that's something that people often forget when they talk about that physical versus digital debate, we also have a lot more ways of getting our games, sometimes through incredible sales and very often through incredible sales. I would venture to say that the number of people who buy the game full priced when it's released is likely lower than the number of people who get it for a cheaper price down the line. Well, I mean, it depends on the game. Some games sell a lot up front. Some of them will have longer legs, but for some, it might be the case. And we have games that are included in subscriptions. We have games that are given away in different through different means. There are many, many ways of getting games, and many more ways of getting games than there were before. Now, there are a ton of games that aren't at the full price of a regular game. Many of the experiences are much cheaper. Indie games, but not only. We've heard that Star Wars Squadrons, the EA game that's coming out in the fall, is going to be $40. It's a smaller experience, and it's, you know, it exists like that. There are also many, many free games, free-to-play games, which some of them are going to nickel and dime you, especially on mobile, but some of them are going to keep all of their microtransactions as non-gameplay affecting cosmetic upgrades, which mean really the gameplay value is intact and you can play them forever without paying anything. You have a ton of ways of monetizing things. What it comes down to in the end, I think all of these points are valid. There's also actually another point that is very valid, which is I'll stop after that. The first one is that games are a very cheap way of passing time. They're a very cheap hobby. And I know it's not something that is popular to say amongst gamers, but as hobbies go, there are very few hobbies that are cheaper than video games. First of all, well, there are a lot of free games, which you can probably play on a device you already own, so you don't even need to buy the device that you need to play them. And even those devices are probably relatively cheap compared to other things, because if you think about other hobbies, I guess if you're going to go out and for a run, you're probably not going to spend a lot of money, possibly your sneakers, but that you can get relatively cheap. But anything else, or not anything else, a lot of other things that are hobbies are much more expensive. If you want to take up some kind of sport activity, you probably need to pay for a club. If you want to go to a gym, you have to pay for that. If you want to, if you're into, okay, let's go to the other extreme. If you're into cars, buying a car is expensive. If you're into golf, golfing is not cheap. If you can, you know, play sports for free, go to the basketball court or stuff like that. But the point is, there are a lot of other, if you like movies, if you want to go to the movies, then we need to start talking about price per hour of entertainment. A movie is 10, 15 bucks, and that's a couple of hours. A game can provide you anywhere between 10 to infinite amount of hours for that full price of 70 bucks. Even 10 hours, that comes down to about $7 per hour. And it's very rare that you're going to have a game that is only going to be useful, quote unquote, for 10 hours. But even that, it's $7 per hour at 70 bucks per game. And that's the roughly the price of the hour of movie entertainment, right? So that is the highest price you're ever going to pay for a game. Many, many of them are either free or lower price and will give you, you know, 20, 30, 50, 50, 100, 300 hours of game time. I have played Overwatch for hundreds of hours and it cost me 40 bucks. So it is actually a very cheap hobby. It is also surprisingly recession resilient. And actually, that is because, of course, it's cheaper to stay home, and it is because it's quite a cheap hobby. The price of a console, even, is a little bit of an investment, but you don't have to buy the latest one at full price. And you can probably game on your PC if you're really broke. There are many, many ways of playing very decent games, even on phones, if you don't have a lot of money. So what I'm trying to say ultimately is the right price, that is what it comes down to. What is the right price for games? Is it 60 bucks? Do we want it to remain 60 bucks forever? How long do we have to keep it at 60 bucks? It's also, of course, buying something for, you know, paying a movie ticket 15 bucks and paying 70 bucks, you have kind of a nominal price, which is higher. 70 bucks is not an insignificant amount of money for many people. So I understand why we think that games are more expensive than other hobbies. But when you think of it in a different way, I think it's clear that, you know, it is actually pretty cheap. But there is that question, you know, can games go up to $70, $80, $100? That symbolically, that price is significant. But ultimately, I think the right price, the right maximum price for a AAA experience, I think it is the price that people are willing to pay. And again, 70 is cheaper than 70 now is cheaper than 60 in 2006. And for the record, before PlayStation arrived in 1995, Nintendo games were, I remember that in old francs, or I mean in francs, not euros, but Nintendo games were about roughly the equivalent of 100 bucks back then. And Sony came in and lowered the price to about 60 in 1995, maybe 50 even. It was a little bit more. No, it was probably 60. The equivalent of that back then. So we actually used to pay games back then 500 francs, which was, you know, a lot of money. It was more than it is even now with that 70 euros. So the price that people are willing to pay is the price you set your price at. And I understand the shock of having to pay more for a thing you've been used to paying 60 bucks for 15 years. But how long do we keep that price at 60, right? With the inflation, it keeps getting higher, you know, that value keeps getting lower and lower. And we can't keep it going for another generation, another two. I'm sorry. That's not how it works. It can't work like that. So for me, I understand the price hike. I think it is, it's going to happen at some point. Of course, not every game is going to be at the full price, but some of them will. And that's how it's going to be. If no one buys the games at that price, then no one will buy them. Maybe they'll consider selling games at a lower price. And that price is the maximum price they set symbolically, kind of. They don't have to sell every game at that high price. But if they can't, push the price at a generation change when they haven't done it in two generations, then they can never do it. And that is not healthy for anyone either. So, bottom line, I'm not super surprised nor against the increase in price. And I don't think it's going to mean we don't get microtransactions anymore, of course, for all the reasons I've mentioned, including the despicable greed of companies that are here to make money. But so that's probably going to happen. And we'll see how gamers react. I doubt that the reaction will be, we don't buy games. Because already, very rarely, I mean, if you want the game the moment it releases and you want it delivered digitally, then you probably have to pay full price. That is the only configuration where you have to pay that full price. If you get it physically, ironically, for a number of reasons we might discuss at another point, if you want it a physical copy, then you might not need to pay full price, which is, yes, incredibly ironic. And if you want to wait, there are many ways of getting the game at a cheaper price. But so that's happening. It's happening. I'm convinced that most first-party games and big AAA titles will be at that high price. And in the case of Microsoft, what that means is the Game Pass is even more attractive now than it was before. And that's a pretty cool... Well, I mean, Game Pass is pretty cool already, which is interesting. I wonder how Sony is going to potentially alter PlayStation Now down the line to match that, but we'll see. Talking about Microsoft, a couple of things. So let's talk about PCs and console manufacturers. First, the two best-selling games in the world at the moment are Horizon Zero Dawn and Sea of Thieves. Two first-party console games, initially. Well, first-party console games, I guess they are. And they are the best. By the way, the legs on Sea of Thieves are incredible. What is happening? It's thanks to the release on Steam, obviously, but that game has been so... The reception has been so lukewarm. And honestly, it seems to have continued to be lukewarm, even though some people like it. I'm even considering checking it out, which... I hadn't considered until now, because now it's making a little bit more noise again and again and again. It keeps doing that. But so that's interesting, and that kind of validates the Microsoft strategy of being everywhere. And Horizon Zero Dawn is seeing reservations and pre-purchases at an incredible rate. And that is also a traditionally first-party game, which, of course, it came out on PlayStation 4 like 3 years ago. But seeing that, I don't see how Sony doesn't make a habit of releasing back catalog, quote-unquote, games to PC. Once you've sold your game for 3 years on your main platform, then why would you not want an additional bag of money by releasing it on PC as well? Of course, some people will say, you know, it will be coming eventually on PC and I'm not going to buy it on PlayStation, whatever. That will be some people. But I doubt that balances out the benefits of putting it out on another platform and getting a buttload of additional money. So I suspect that will be a common practice in the future. And I don't see how that could not be the case. Unless, you know, Sony, which is a money-loving corporation, actually doesn't love money, which, again, I don't think that would be the case. So we'll see. We'll see what happens there. But talking about exclusives and platforms, it seems we talked about a couple of weeks ago that the fact that Warner Brothers might be willing to sell, AT&T actually might be willing to sell Warner Brothers Interactive, which holds the licenses to the Warner Brothers properties for video games. And Microsoft, we said at the time, you know, EA, Activision, Blizzard, Take-Two, many of them, many of the big publishers, of course, might be interested. But Microsoft is interested as well, according to the latest rumors, which would be, I think, earth-shattering for the panorama of gaming for the next few years. Because Warner Brothers Interactive has a lot of very strong titles and IPs that would strengthen Microsoft's position in a way that, I, in my estimation, all of the previous purchases did not. They made, of course, a bunch of purchases, but in the package that Warner Brothers Interactive includes, you have Rocksteady, incredible studio that made the Batman Arkham series, and that has other things, which means, oh, by the way, of course, all of the DC Universe licenses, I believe, come with it. There is, they would be given, I'm sure, an opportunity to buy the licenses with them. And I think if Microsoft was to do this, they would want to get the licenses as well. It wouldn't make sense to only buy the studios and not get the licenses. So for the sake of discussion, I'm assuming that they would be willing to first reimburse the debt of all of those studios and the willingness to buy out the licenses for those games. But so Rocksteady Studios, NetherRealm, which is Mortal Kombat, the Lego games, Middle Earth games from Monolith Productions, a bunch of, you know, there are a number of other games, WB Games Montreal, Avalanche Software, which, by the way, also includes the Harry Potter series, thanks to the licensing with Warner Brothers. So that would be really, really big if they do end up getting them. And of course, it would be big for any studio, you know, if EA or Activision gobbles up Warner Brothers Interactive. And again, I'm including in that assumption the fact that they would get the licenses with those. So that would be pretty big. But for Microsoft, of course, it would mean in the console wars, Microsoft gets all of that with it. And they become Xbox / PC, but Xbox exclusives. And that is a big thing, especially when you realize that probably all of those will be included in Game Pass. That would be huge. Not that Game Pass isn't already huge, but that would make them, I think that would put them on the exclusives war. Sony clearly has a leg up at the moment. We'll see what Microsoft is cooking, but clearly Sony has a leg up. That would bring them significantly closer to Sony. So that would be really big. I'm rooting for Microsoft to get them. I think it would be a much better home for all of those licenses than arguably any of the other big publishers. But we'll see. And talking about information on what's happening with Microsoft, we're getting a Xbox showcase on July 23rd. That's less than 2 weeks away. It is extremely exciting. We're also going to get the Ubisoft Forward, which is going to be streamed in just a few days here. So we're going to get a number of new games and announcements. It seems that theoretically the July 23rd showcase for the Xbox would be our first look at Halo Infinite, finally, and potentially a price reveal for the Xbox Series X. I mean, at this point, we're in the middle of summer. If they don't reveal the price for Series X, I don't know what's happening. Like, I guess they could reveal it in August. But and by the way, in August, they would be revealing the Series S, which, according to rumors, could potentially be launched or could have been launched after the Series X. So they would launch the Series X first, again, according to rumors, that it might have been launched in August. Of course, coronavirus, the COVID-19 has jumbled those plans, but it could have been launched for the Series X in August and the Series S in the fall, October or November. But regardless, we're going to see games in July in just a couple of weeks, and then the Series S, according to the rumors, in August. So we'll see how that goes. And for the showcase, the games showcase, we're going to have a number of, a large number, between 75 and 100 game demos playable on Xbox One for a week. That kind of takes the place of an E3 that didn't happen. So a lot of exciting stuff happening there. If Microsoft manages to get Warner Brothers to sign it, and announce it with the licenses during that July 23rd. That Phil Spencer, almost said Phil Schiller. Phil Spencer comes on screen and he's like, "We're so happy to be welcoming a number of amazing studios into the Microsoft Studios family. NetherRealm Studios, Rocksteady, etc., etc. And we will be, getting that license." It would be the biggest news of this E3, quote unquote, season. It would be, okay, granted, the bar isn't that high to clear. Even I count the reveals of PlayStation 5 and Xbox One, and Xbox Series X in that. Maybe I shouldn't. I'm being cheeky. But it would be amazing news. We'll see. Maybe it's too, there isn't enough time for that to happen. But, if Microsoft has a lot of money, if they want it, maybe they can get it. Maybe Spencer is in Satya Nadella's office all the time these past few days going like, "Satya, we really need that studio. We need those. Come on, give me the money. It will be amazing." I'm guessing that's not how that conversation goes. Oh, and by the way, talking about Game Pass, we've had a couple of really interesting pieces of feedback from developers who are saying how beneficial being included in the Game Pass is for their sales outside of Game Pass. That's something that Phil Spencer has said more than once, that being on Game Pass actually is beneficial for games. And that's easy to understand. It's, you're on Game Pass, a lot of people play it, they talk about the games to their friends, those friends don't really want to be on Game Pass and pay the subscription, so they want to check out the game, it's cheap enough, they buy it. In this case, it's Descenders, which is a bike, mountain bike game, but that we've heard about this this precept, this claim for a while, and we have at least one or two people who are saying, yes, that's true, it's being super positive for our game, which is good to hear, because of course there are a lot of questions that come with these types of subscriptions. Is it beneficial for game studios is one of them. So it's really nice to hear that for them, at least it is. Let's switch to other companies. Shuhei Yoshida has announced that he is launching the PlayStation Indies initiative. Shuhei Yoshida is one of the top execs at Sony, of course, if you don't know. PlayStation Indies is a program that is going to focus on making sure indies are at home on PlayStation, which is great because back in the PS3 era, in the early PS3, I would say, and maybe even at the beginning of PS4, indies were really interesting on PlayStation. And as time has gone on, it's not that they have disappeared, but we didn't feel the same commitment by Sony to that type of games. So now there is going to be a dedicated initiative that is going to try to make sure this is going to work out for the indies. So that, I think, is pretty cool. The other thing I wanted to talk about is the new game by Ubisoft, the Battle Royale called Hyperscape? Hyperscape, yes. So I've had a chance to play it during the technical beta, is how it's called, I think. So I guess the first question is, a Battle Royale, really? Aren't you like 2 years late? And maybe they are, it's possible, but it's also possible that they can have a little, they can carve out their niche in that space. And I don't think, you know, of course, there are a number of big games in that genre. PUBG is still huge. Fortnite is the hugest thing ever. Apex Legends seems to be very successful still. Warzone, Call of Duty is definitely not going away. That's a lot of players, I guess, but is it? Hyperscape seems like a relatively modest project, and it has some very unique characteristics that means it might carve out its niche. It looks like a hybrid between a classic military battle royale, taking the elements of battle royale, and an arena, almost hero shooter. It is super fast. Movement is ridiculous. You double jump, you rush out, you have special abilities. That is really interesting, actually. You get weapons, of course, which you don't really have to upgrade with different bits of upgrades. If you find the same weapon again, you fuse it with the one you have, and it increases its, stats. And the other aspect is elements that you find, little tools, abilities, that you have two of them, which makes it kind of similar to an Overwatch, for example. And you get those two abilities in the same way, meaning if you find another one, there are maybe 10 different ones that exist. And if you find another one of the ones you already have, you fuse it and it increases its stats or reduces its cooldown and stuff like that. And you have ridiculous movement things. You have a leap, how's it called? Maybe leap, I can't remember. You have a ball, you can transform into a ball and jump like a giant ball jumping around everywhere. You have a healing ability, you have armor. It is, maybe it lacks a little bit of clarity, but it is definitely on the fun side of things. We've definitely left the military aspect and fun in a way, in a neon, almost Tron type way, which is not unpleasant. And I think it is a really interesting take on that genre. And I wonder if there is a space for it, even in a saturated, maybe it will bring people, more people who aren't into the battle royale military thing and who aren't into building stuff in Fortnite. So it is super fast. Time to kill is long, meaning you have a lot of health and you have to shoot people a lot to get them down, which I think might be a little bit too much because it means you don't die as much. So that's satisfying, but you also don't kill as many people easily if you're not very good like me. So there's that. You can revive if you don't completely die when you're dead. You can inform your teammates on some things and then you can revive. It's interesting. Overall, I have found that it was a cool game. I think it's a cool game. I don't know how much I'm going to be playing it. It's a case of there are too many great things in the gaming world. And so just a cool thing might not be enough for me. But maybe it's going to be someone else's jam. Maybe it's going to be a lot of someone else's jams. And it's not going to be the biggest battle royale ever. But maybe it's going to be fun enough that with a smaller community, you know, maybe you only need 100,000 people to play it regularly to make it viable. That you don't necessarily have to have 2 million people playing it every week to make it a viable game. I don't know, but maybe that is what they're looking at. And certainly it looks like production value-wise, it's not an enormous investment for Ubisoft. So they're trying something, they're being realistic about it. I think it's an interesting one. Again, it's called Hyperscape, and we're getting in a few days. I think the demo ends today, but we're going to get the launch, I think, by the time Ubisoft Forward's world rolls around, and that's going to be in just a few days. So, yeah, so there's that. Crucible is going back in closed beta. Crucible is Amazon's latest game, which came out like a month ago. And I mean, I don't want to be mean, but I don't think I've ever seen any game go back into closed beta. And that's to their credit. You know, it's not working out. They don't have enough concurrent players. They're going back in closed beta. They want to work with the existing community on improving it, and they're going to relaunch hopefully at some point. We've seen a lot of games that have been worked on for a long time and just kept online. This one is actually being retired, which is a bit strange, but they're not letting it die. They're still working on it, I guess. It is strange that, you know, those big tech companies are not managing to, even with all their money and power, aren't managing to make great games out of the box. I guess it happens to all kinds of publishers and developers, but I don't know. This one was an interesting one. If you haven't seen it, the teaser trailer for Shadow Warrior 3 is really fun. I didn't know of that franchise, but that teaser definitely got me interested in it, and I went and bought Shadow Warrior 2 on Steam, and it turns out I played for a little bit. It's fun. It is kind of, as someone, Mentis, I think, in my community put it, it's kind of the weird mix between Deadpool and Sekiro. But anyway, I'm not going to spend too much time on that game, but Shadow Warrior 3, the teaser trailer is fun, and I'm really looking forward to seeing the gameplay, because even though the second one had huge issues in gunplay, essentially it's an FPS and you can also wield a sword, and so it's a mix between melee and FPS, and the S shooter of FPS is really not up to stuff. The gun feel is horrendous. So if they can keep the humor, make it a little bit less a little bit less, how do I put this? The humor is a little bit crass, I'll say that. So a little bit less crass, but still there, the breaking the fourth wall, the Deadpool type of everything. I think it's got potential. I'll definitely look into it. Pokemon Go is breaking records now. Like, it's doing better than it has been in its entire history. What the hell is happening with Pokemon Go? I guess people are still playing it even when they don't have to go outside. Maybe that's why they're playing it more. But I think it's notable that Pokemon Go is such a big success, even now, 2-3 years after its release. What was it? Pokemon Go, is it 2016? No. 2017, I think. I'll check. I'm checking live. 2016, 4 years later. That is remarkable. Good on them. As if, you know, because Pokemon needed a little bit of a push. It was kind of a difficult franchise. It was difficult for them to survive. So, the open world Harry Potter game is on track for 2021. That is something that is, I think, quite exciting. I mean, okay, it could be really fun. It could be a total dud. But if it's well done, it could be a super fun thing. So it's still on track. They kind of announced it, and they made it very clear that J.K. Rowling had very little involvement with the game, which I found humorous but understandable for reasons I'm sure you're aware of. But yeah, that was funny. Bethesda is teasing a TV adaptation of Fallout on Amazon Prime. And that is, you know, it's not the first gaming adaptation we've seen, but there are some, it seems we're there. It seems we're, of course, The Witcher was one that was, you know, it's live action. I'm guessing this is live action as well, but The Witcher was a big one. And we have The Last of Us Part 2 on HBO, Fallout on Amazon Prime. It seems we're at a point where games are getting their live action equivalent. It's not movies. Movies never cracked it. But maybe TV shows will. And that makes sense because TV shows have time enough time to install the complexity of some video games, not of all video games, but the character development, all of that. It's, you know, when you want to make an adaptation of Mortal Kombat, you can't do it in a movie. You have to have a series. Actually, Mortal Kombat has gotten a lot better on the, a lot more fun on the story side recently, but in recent years. So yeah, Fallout on Amazon Prime. It could be very cool. I think I'm legally required to mention that Donkey Kong Country is coming to Nintendo Switch Online this month, which I was never a big Donkey Kong Country fan. And everyone seems to be losing their minds about the fact that it's coming to the Switch Online system. So if you like the Super Nintendo Donkey Kong Country, it's coming to Switch. And I also wanted to mention that Tencent is launching a studio, a wholly owned studio in Los Angeles called Lightspeed LA. This is really interesting because they are really attacking Western audiences now. They own a large part of the Chinese market and Asian market in gaming. And they are now trying to take a look at the Western market as well, not just by bringing their Eastern games to the West, but also, or, you know, to taking participation or completely purchasing Western studios, but actually developing new studios in the West. So I'm very curious to see what they will be developing. So I guess we'll see. Oh, hey, I'm back. I don't know if you heard the little one come in and cry from behind me, but yeah, so I had to interrupt for the last couple of minutes of the show, really, because the last thing I wanted to mention is that the second, third wave of Me Too in the gaming industry is still going. And Ubisoft seems to be the main target of the allegations. And things are moving there. There are a number of executives that have either left their job or been fired or suspended pending allegations, investigations. The president of the company, Yves Guillemot, has made a significant statement that he is taking these things seriously, and there have been discussions about how seriously he's been taking them, because it's, according to many, it's unlikely that he didn't realize these things were happening. And so, you know, I don't know how seriously you can take the declarations, the statement, and he's saying that he's going to have a new head of diversity and inclusion and independent audit and a new head of something else. Bottom line, it seems to me he's taking it seriously. Some people are saying there need to be more actionable, verifiable promises, which some of them I'm sure might be desirable. I'm sure some of them are also like, it's trapping yourself into something that you don't want to. But I think my ultimate estimation at the moment about these things is that the proof will be in the pudding. We've seen companies, it's difficult to evaluate these things on promises, obviously. Some promises can be empty, some can be sincere. Maybe some sincere ones end up not yielding the effects you wanted. But we've seen a couple of times in recent years, I think Riot Games was the previous wave, the main target of the previous wave of Me Too a couple of years ago. And my understanding is that culture has shifted at Riot Games with the sincere efforts of the managing structure. That might not be the case. Maybe I'm misunderstanding what happened there. But my understanding is that it does It has shifted. There's also slightly related to these issues in the sense that they were made public and there was a lot of outrage over them. The issue of crunch and, quite frankly, toxic company culture at Rockstar seems to have been addressed at least partially following the reports from members of the press and the courageous denunciations, the courageous testimonies of members of those companies, and the potentially empty promises of the executives, which ended up, well, I shouldn't say potentially empty, I mean estimated to be empty promises by some people who were looking at them, but they ended up being, what I'm trying to say, I'm muddling the point. Company culture seems to have changed at Rockstar as well. And maybe it will happen at Ubisoft, maybe it won't. I think it's difficult not to look at the apparent seriousness of Yves Guillemot's statement without at least a little bit of hope. The people who have come forward have mixed opinions. Some of them are saying, you know, I've seen that before, or given what I've lived through, I have a hard time believing that it will be, this is actually sincere. Some of them are saying we'll wait and see. I'm more on the wait and see camp. Obviously this has to have effects. And hopefully it will. We've seen that it can work in some other companies. And this is the way things should move forward. They don't change overnight. But I'm seeing a lot of what I think should be the things that happen when these victims come forward. In those, you know, I talked a lot about Ubisoft, but I think that is being replicated everywhere. There are consequences. Again, with Ubisoft, there have been very serious consequences for the people who were accused. And there should be consequences in other areas as well. We've seen this with some pretty horrendous accusations against the president, or the, is he CEO? Yes, CEO of Evo, which is the fighting game competition. And he's been ousted, and Evo Online, which had other problems anyway, not related to anything, you know, harassment or anything like that, but that has been canceled. And in the gaming, in the fighting game community, we've seen a lot of accusations as well. And from what I've seen, I don't think it's anything bubbly. It's not a bubble, because when people are being angry, stereotypical angry gamers, I usually see those views being expressed as well. And what I've seen now is a whole lot of good riddance, you know, a whole lot of people saying, this is not what behavior we want to see in our community, which honestly might seem obvious when you're talking about sexual harassment and sexism. But again, think of a few years ago. That wasn't a given. That is not what we would have expected to happen. As incoherent as it might sound, it might seem in our heads, I'm only seeing behaviors or reactions that are taking the side of the anti-sexism, anti-sexual harassment, anti-bro company culture camp. So I hope this is a significant step in the right direction. I'm saddened and a little bit discouraged by the fact that we're needing to see another wave of those things for, you know, that it's necessary to see yet another one of those things. We've had, as I said, maybe at least one big one. The Riot Games one is, you know, the Riot Games change happened in the previous wave. I'm hoping there won't be a third one. You know, I mentioned on Twitter something along the lines of, you know, this is the second wave. if you're a video game publisher or developer, or, you know, in any industry really, but especially in the gaming industry, don't wait for wave three to do something. You know, don't wait for your company's name to be associated with wave three, with something like that, to do something about it. I think you should have looked into your company culture and put things in place already a while ago, at the very least at wave one. But now wave two, you have to, even if you think you're fine, I think, well, I'm not an expert on the topic, so obviously look into someone serious, and, you know, some, I'm sure there are consulting companies that can tell you what to do. But it seems to me that at the very least, if you're a moderately sized company, a way to report these kinds of things anonymously and to an independent third party is a minimum. So that you at least are aware. Obviously, we've seen again and again, HR is not equipped to deal with these things. And HR is an internal structure. So it seems to make sense that, you know, they usually it doesn't work. Maybe when we have shifted the culture enough to not have sexism and sexual harassment part of the fabric of our society, maybe at that point, HR will be capable of handling these things. It seems that the moment they are not. So at the very least, I think putting in place a third party that people can go to talk about these issues, and so that you can know about them, seems like a minimum. But, you know, that's my feeling from everything I've read and everything I understand about these issues and how to tackle them. But obviously, again, I'm not an expert. I'm not even especially directly concerned by, not concerned, that's a Frenchism. I'm not, you know, directly involved in those things. So go look it up. You probably have the means if you're the head of a big company, but yeah, don't wait for wave three. Don't wait to be associated with this in a very negative manner, because as we've seen, it is part of, unfortunately, the society, our culture, and it seems even more because there are so many men in the gaming industry, our industry. It is a bro frat house culture, or it has been. It's changing, and it seems inevitable. And I would say maybe it was inevitable until now, but it isn't anymore. And from this point forward, to be honest, from a couple of points back forward, but from this point forward, if this is still happening in your structure, then I would argue before it might not quite have been your fault, maybe arguably like this is how things worked, as horrible as that sounds. But now, from now on, it is definitely your responsibility. If things keep happening, you can't say you didn't know, right? So look into that. All right, that's it. I hope you had a good time. I hope you got something out of this show. And I definitely had a fun time with you. We'll see. I'm supposed to go on vacation for a few weeks, right at the moment where all of those things happen. So we'll see if I do mid-vacation shows, which means it won't be vacations anymore, but maybe I will. I don't know. We'll see. But regardless, if I don't talk to you now, I will probably talk to you in the fall. And we'll summarize everything that has been happening. So in the fall, in a few weeks, it's okay. Fine, I'll be back. And I'll talk to you then. Not Patrick on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. If you want to see, by the way, my son being adorable, you can follow me on Instagram or Twitter, but Instagram is more fun. And I will talk to you in a few weeks. Bye.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to. courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.